Yeah, I mean, because that was obviously that was what I discussed in my response to reading your books about Taxi Driver, and just that tension and cognitive dissonance of wanting there to be a way to just establish one's own subjective point of view as objectively true and banish the evil interloper, you know, of a contrary viewpoint. And you know, back in when I wrote Blood Poets, was, you know, I was quite an amoral person back then in philosophy. I mean, not in terms of action, but I wouldn't say, fortunately, but I consider morality to be just a false construct and all that stuff. And one of the things I wrote in Blood Poets was about natural born killers, which I liked. That if we're going to say that at the end of the day, morality is just a question of taste, which I don't, by the way, believe anymore, but then that means by extrapolation that taste is no less a question than morality. And so, I mean, in reference to what you're asking now, it seems that the correlation between morality and taste is discernment, the ability to discern whether something is benign or not, let's say, so good in a wider sense than just aesthetic. And I do think that now, at least, I might not have thought back then, that a work, a movie that is a good movie or a great movie, it has to be benign. It has to at least have the potential for having positive effects for the viewer. Otherwise, what is it? You know, it's at best, it's just a time killer, and yeah, it's entertainment, and entertainment isn't art, although art is entertainment. So, so then it's like, well, that, so that was what it came down to with our discussion about texture, wasn't it? Was I felt I had to, or I chose the best argument I could make was for the effects that Taxi Driver had for me, why I saw Taxi Driver as benign and as a great movie. And that is, it's not separate from the aesthetic appreciation of Taxi Driver at all. It's part of, you know, it's all part of one experience, but it's, I would say it's a wider perspective, because it's not just looking at, because there are movies that are brilliantly done and can persuade us that there are, for sure, but they are, I think, Trojan horses for pernicious ideological, you know, packages of information. And I don't think it's either or, I do think it's the spectrum. So certainly with something like Matrix, it's inescapable that was a mass corporate product that led to video games and crappy sequels and all the rest. There's no way I could argue for that being an inherently benign cultural phenomenon, because it's so intrinsic and representative to a culture that I see as malign. But it doesn't mean that it wasn't still able to serve as a carrier for something benign. So that's like the flip side of a Trojan horse, isn't it? It actually, I guess it's three leveled. It looks like a Trojan horse for most people, as in it's this wonderful movie, but inside there's these ideological, you know, messages about violence, you know, glorification of violence and the individual and all that, because they're inescapable in our culture. But inside that, there's a third layer, which is this more mythical core, which the makers of that film somehow became receptacles for, and they transmitted it. I'd say the same about Fight Club. I don't know what you think of the movie and if you've read the book, but the movie, in my view, is much better than the book, and it's much more interesting, and I'd say it's more potentially subversive is a word I used to use positively, but now I'm not sure, but more more benign, let's say, can help an individual sort of reconcile tensions in his own psyche and understand it. But that movie was definitely a corporate project too. Like, there were all these different people involved. It wasn't just the work of one or two artists, the way that the book was, or the way that something like The Wild Bunch was. It seemed to be just this congruence, or this coming together of, it's like lightning striking, really. Just all these elements came together at a particular moment, same year as Matrix, and somehow something was able to come through. Jung would say from the collective unconscious, but essentially it's a modern myth. It took a snapshot of the collective psyche at that time, and it really closely represented something, and so it became a cult movie. And I'd say that was despite it being a corporate carrier for, ideological memes of, that serve the system as a whole. That it's like the God in the machine. There's something there that was able to get through. And I would say the critic's role is to isolate in some way by testifying to his or her own experiences of the film, isolating what is of value in there, assuming there is something of value, so that the viewer can then see the film or return to the film or just re-experience the film by reading the review in a way that actually increases the potential of that film to have a benign effect, to convey the real meaning that it has to convey. So it's like midwifing in a way. I mean, for me, Cale midwifed me into movies, but also certain movies into me. Like, I saw them through her eyes. The whole of Blood Post was written to her as a response to her. And that had value in and of itself as a dialogue. But the thing that Cale did that I valued so much was that she put herself into the, her work as a critic was, it was autobiographical. She was conveying her responses to the movie so eloquently that they became infectious. Like, one started having the same responses she was having.
And I think that is definitely something that a critic can do for audiences. A critic can open up audiences to certain films in perhaps ways that they would not have done so or been able to do so without the critic. And yeah, I think what you're saying makes me think that there are there's certain I'm wondering if it centers around a lot in terms of the whole notion of identification and like what you're saying, the quality of response to conflict and the because when I look back at Taxi Driver, I can't help but see that it is extremely powerful film. I mean, there's no question about that, and it's well made and it's well acted. And so I ask myself, well, what's the problem with it? And the only thing that I can come up with has been the structure, in the sense that, and it's something I didn't think to emphasize enough when we were talking about The Godfather. But the thing for me is, and the more I think about those two films, is that the what I call contrapuntal characters don't really exist in those films, in the sense that most of the characters, if not all the characters, are in some sense victims, as is perhaps the hero himself, a victim of himself. Everyone is a victim in one way or another, and there's no one who stands outside that circle of victimage. And I think a contrapuntal character is someone who does stand outside of it, at least in some important aspect, so that they provide a glimpse for the audience at what the hero or anti-hero is doing that gives them pause, that says, okay, we're not really saying that these actions are heroic. We're showing the sense in which it leads down, you know, a path, a dark path. And the contrapuntal character is someone who kind of guides the audience. And, you know, I will grant that maybe that's heavy-handed, and maybe a lot of filmmakers like Scorsese don't really want to go that direction and try to build in that kind of a hint for the audience. Then when I look at some character like Hinckley, who the way he viewed the film, and I think, well, if there had been a character like that in the film, it might have helped Hinckley to see himself in a different light rather than heroizing Bickle and heroizing himself and not confronting himself in a sufficient way, because certainly that film Taxi Driver ought to lead someone to an extreme kind of confrontation with themselves if they are identifying with this character. But clearly, if they're not identifying with the character and the conflict in, as you say, the right way or in a quality way, then you can have an outcome that speaks an entirely different way to a member of the audience. And it might even be a very small percentage. But as Michael Medved says about advertising, you say, you know, advertisers generally only try to appeal to 1% of the audience. And if they can get that 1%, they're happy.
It's enough, yeah.
And if there's 1% out in the audience who is not reading Taxi Driver the right way, then I might say, well, perhaps we could even reduce the possibilities of that 1% reading it the wrong way if we structured it just a little bit differently, telling basically the same story.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible though that's sort of targeting the wrong culprit, a kind of scapegoating of a movie? Because isn't it possible that this 1%, or less than 1%, maybe in the case of Taxi Driver and Hinckley, and leaving aside my own views about Hinckley, of course, and what happened there, but just say, I mean, the Natural Born Killers is perhaps an example I'd be more willing to concede might have just been a random thing of viewers seeing it and going out and killing. And certainly a much stronger case could be made for Natural Born Killers being irresponsible as art, I think. But anyway, whatever, there's this small number of individuals who are triggered by works like that and they go out and act on it, rather than looking at the work itself and how could it be changed, might it not be wise to consider that individuals of that kind, if they weren't triggered by this work or that work, they would be triggered by something else. Considering the nature of our culture, and like a movie, surely a movie like True Lies, or what are the ones I single out? Well, the Rambo movies, or even Dirty Harry. I mean, surely these are going to be far more pernicious in terms of really overtly glorifying violence, as compared to a movie that certainly has a great deal of ambiguity and you know, presents a more nuanced view of the anti-hero. Not that it's either or. I mean, I'm sure you would not spare those movies, but I guess you want to sort of go into more subtle areas of questioning. And regarding the contrapuntal thing, I have a couple of questions about that. One is, which you touched on really, like how realistic would it be? How possible would it be to interject a character into Taxi Driver that served that function without invalidating the whole structure of the movie? Ditto with a Godfather. Like, is it possible that that could be done and be realistic? My first question. My second question is more of a proposition. What if, or have you considered that the contrapuntal character, or the opportunity there is that the contrapuntal character is us, the viewer?
Well, I think that what you just said about us, being a viewer, that's correct. Yeah, and all I'm suggesting is that some viewers might need a little more help, and there may be nuances and subtleties that could be worked in that even the average viewer would appreciate through a contrapuntal character. And to give a specific example of that, in response to the notion of how would you work in a contrapuntal character into Taxi Driver? I think a good example of that is in The Sopranos. I don't know how much of that series you may have seen,
Just the
but
first season or the first half, I didn't actually get involved in it. But anyway, carry on.
well, there's a character in there, Dr. Melfi, who is the psychiatrist that Tony Soprano goes to because he's having problems with panic attacks. And the Melfi becomes a character who is a fairly prominent in the series and provides the representation, let's say, for the audience, for the contrapuntal character who is taking a look at Tony and saying, "Wow, let's what's going on here?" And I think it's very interesting, and she is able to talk about things and look at things that perhaps even the average member of the audience would overlook. And kind of show a way of really examining in some depth, the perversity of Tony's character. And I thought it was a very clever and important thing that they did because they could have left her completely out and built this, story all around Soprano and his nefarious activities. And tried, like in the manner of Taxi Driver, to show him to be descending deeper and deeper into a kind of dark space. But in that series, and that's why I gave it a more favorable review, because I felt that the Melfi character really served well in that capacity. But I do think, you raise a good point. With respect to, how do you do that without really ruining or messing up a drama? I think it can be done, but I don't necessarily think it's easy. And it does require some good writing. And that may be the difficulty in that, in Hollywood these days, people don't want to write. They just want to put stuff out there that makes money.
Yeah. Well, there's, I mean, there's another thing. I mean, with the specifics of Taxi Driver, it is an example of a movie that was very much the product of individual sensibilities. But starting with Paul Schrader, so he wrote that as a wrestling with his demons, let's say, his addiction to pornography and his loneliness. He wrote that script in a very short period of time. Scorsese and De Niro ended up doing it. They were both wrestling with their own respective demons, not quite so clear in their cases because they obviously it's not written down in black and white. But still, from what I read about the movie and just from watching the movie itself, you can see that they had shared psychological issues, let's say, that they were struggling with. And that's really what the film is about, in my view. It's like creating a mythical narrative or an archetypal narrative about the lone killer and all the violence. It's kind of semi-melodramatic, I'd say, in order to represent sort of subtler, more internal struggles. And that, of course, was its appeal to me. And so that's very different from structuring a work, consciously to have an effect. That's really that's the sort of cliched view we have of the artist who's just working out his own psychological issues and it's just all coming out sort of right brain, intuitively and so on and so forth. And I think that this might be I might be able to connect this to the other point I'd make about Taxi Driver and movies of this sort and why they don't have contrapuntal characters or don't need them, in my view, is that the appeal for them is that we are actually, and you were talking earlier about how movies can provide us with a surrogate experience that we can't have directly, that movies of this kind give us an opportunity, like Dante's Inferno, although of course in that he did have a guide, but anyway, to go into really dark areas and experience ourselves almost being lost without any guide or any, and coming out the other side, and so that we have a vicarious experience of what it would be like, to be in a world where there was just suffering and confusion and victims and corruption and all of that, which may represent experiences that we had as children or moments at least where we felt like that. But whatever the case, there seems potentially value in that, I would say, in our time, in our current times. I'd say that's symptomatic of our times, that alienation is so profound for many people, and that maybe you can't separate, like you couldn't have that, you couldn't provide that without risking that some viewers would get so lost that they came out lost, that they had to identify with Travis or Michael Corleone because they couldn't bear to not to. They couldn't bear to be just lost, in that context without somebody to identify with and see as benign. And so they clutch to the straw of identification, and then they come out saying, "Yeah, I want to be Travis Bickle."
Yeah, well, that's a good point that you're making. I think that yeah, there's a sense in which someone, let's say, who is not a fan of what I'm how I'm approaching dramatic structure might say, well, Désilets seems to be someone who wants for us to put a Boy Scout in our films to help the reader or help the viewer along the way of finding their way, so as not to get lost. And it may be a bit too much of a moralistic kind of patriarchal way of approaching the whole cultural thing.
Right, putting a mansplainer
Yes, it's like, excuse me, ladies, can I
in
jump in here and just explain this for you? Yeah, and I have a horrible tendency to want to do that anyway in my life, and so I can see where that comes from, but I do believe that that there may be cases where clever writers can build in certain characters that like in Sopranos, where I at least personally I found it to be a very good series, and a lot of other people did too. It wasn't like everybody was saying, "Oh, you know, that character Melfi has got to go. You know, she ruined the whole story." So I think it can be done in a very high art level, but certainly I have to concede your point too, in that it's certainly possible that audiences need to, in a certain way, figure it out for themselves and be left to do so. And I would never be one to advocate any form of censorship in that regard. I would simply want to maybe make recommendations and suggestions as to how artists and filmmakers might structure things, but never censorship. But then I was tending too to look at films like Taxi Driver and The Godfather as almost signs of decadence of our culture. And you have at least brought me to the point where, you know, like, say, hold on a minute, Désolé, I don't think that's a very clear sign of decadence. These films make statements that to most people are going to be, you know, profound and worthwhile. So I think you've convinced me of that. I'm less inclined to toss these films out with the bathwater, so to speak. So that's a good thing, I think.
Well, sort of ironic because, as you know from seeing that scene, I've been more and more inclined to look at great works of art, well, works that I consider great works of art, from modern times, from recent times, as signs of decadence, you know, that I was kind of seduced into embracing. And it's certainly not either or. And I mean, insofar as Taxi Driver or The Godfather represent decadent individuals and decadent circumstances, they're certainly signs of decadence. And insofar as movies have become so central to our lives in terms of providing an escape, and that actually our forms of escapism have become more and more darker and more populated by victims and victimizers and so on, all of that is certainly indicates decadence. I wouldn't argue with you there at all, but it just seems to pick out the movies that I would say that are the most responsible. When you've got movies like Hostel, which is a truly despicable work, or even some of Tarantino's work, I would say verges on the despicable. Not that you let Tarantino off the hook, I know he's in there too, but I think there really are cases to be made for art that is really pernicious, or not art, but you know, movies, that is really pernicious and that really clearly demonstrates a vicious sort of sadistic impulse within the filmmakers and thereby, by extension, within audiences that's catering to that in audiences, as opposed to just inadvertently appealing to it, as in the case of Taxi Driver or Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That, yeah, you may be, on the one hand, coming down too hard, but on the other hand, you may not be up to speed in a certain sense, and just how bad things are. I mean, you probably are aware, but you might not even want to watch those movies. I certainly don't watch them. But I would say that, yeah, perhaps that in a certain sense, things are much worse than you're indicating. But that makes your project, I would say, all the more valid. But it also would mean that it requires a lot of innovation, I think, about, you know, what can you do? Because you can't, if you're talking about not just counteracting movies that are slightly irresponsible or inadvertently irresponsible. Like, I mean, I'd say Fight Club is a good example of that. It definitely has quite fascistic overtones, and you can definitely see how that would glorify violence. But movies like that, it's not just movies like that, but movies that really are just outright vicious. What's it gonna entail to counteract that? Not that I think it necessarily can be done, but as you're in a sort of literary project of trying to understand, how dramatic structures influence us and how they could be looked at or applied more responsibly. It seems as though that, although I'm not particularly in sympathy with the specifics of your project, the generalities, it seems as though they're very close to what I'm looking at with my work, essentially, is how are these narratives deceptive? How are they irresponsible? How are they pernicious? How are they being consciously or unconsciously shaped in order to propagandize us into, distorted, delusional forms of behavior? That's absolutely my own project.
Yeah, and I think that's where I've really responded to your work, because I think you're doing a great job in that regard. Yeah, and that's the question, how do we have a positive influence on the culture without being moralizing and pedantic and irrelevant, basically. How do we get in there and really try to participate in a way that's helpful? And I sense in your work you're doing that, and that's what I really admire about it. And we do share that, because that's what I want to be doing. And I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that, although I will now give a pass to films like Godfather and Taxi Driver, that I think that, overall our culture is not decadent. I think we are, slipping into decadence in so many different ways, and so that's why for me it's important, especially to try to bolster up our educational institutions and to find ways to say something to kids coming up through the culture. To say, to at least point in some directions where they might look to get some positive modeling instead of things that I think are going to be, so negative in the long run.
Yes, well, I'm tempted to say good luck with that, but I don't want to be glib either. But I think you're swimming against the current there, and it might be a tidal wave.
Yeah.
It's ironic because the kind things that you said about my work, which I gratefully accept, and I hope that they're true because that is part of my intention. They're almost side effects, and because I was very opposed to that whole endeavor, like of trying to steer people in the right direction or to moralize or anything like that. I was really opposed to that for reasons that we already touched on in this conversation. But it's come about organically by examining my own relationship to the world, really, and trying to extricate myself from some very destructive beliefs and behaviors that can be sourced in the culture. So I guess you could say, insofar as I'm being effective at all, and I'm so incredibly marginal, so I don't believe I'm having any effect on the culture, but there are individuals who seem to have been positively impacted by what I've done. And insofar as that is the case, it's by modeling, I think, as opposed to lecturing, because I'm trying to work something out publicly, then it's kind of the inverse of, preaching or instructing or teaching, because I'm really just presenting my own struggle. my own confusion to the world while working it out.
I think that's why your work has resonated so well with me, because the authenticity of it just comes through, not to mention, you know, the fact that you have a very a kind of a more natural and genuine stylistic approach in your writing, whereas mine is more academic because of the context I came out of and trying to publish in academic journals. I learned how to, I had to, I mean, it was a learning process. You really had to write, and then rewrite, revision after revision, finally getting academic journals to accept your work. The parameters there are very rigid. And so the speech and the writing that comes out becomes very stilted. But, and this is a complaint that I've gotten from many of my friends who read my work. and it does get to be rather preacherly, I think, which is, that's what was so refreshing about your work, is that I could read it. I could see elements in it of what, I could resonate to with things that I was trying to say, but you had found, a very, I think a more authentic kind of, you know, a more authentic feeling kind of way to say it. And, so that's admirable. And, I would, you know, the current thing that I'm working on and writing is going to be probably more of the same, but, I may try to find some ways to bend it in certain ways to make it sound more authentic and appeal to people at a more passionate level. But it's a work in progress.
Thank you.
Well, liminality, right, is an anti-structure, and as speaking to what we were discussing just a moment ago about the need, the possibility of the benefit of being getting lost in a narrative. Or in a make-believe world, or in a movie, so that you don't, there are no guides, there are no contrapuntal characters. It's just what's happening there. It's a simulation of some sort of reality that's quite dark, and it's this kind of stream of consciousness on the part of the artist to some extent, or at least it's a very organic unfolding, and that also implies a lack of structure, a lack of things to fall back on or rely on or cling to, and so that would speak to what you're saying about academic writing, that you had to really learn the structure, and now you've internalized it. It's like you can't get it out of you, so it could strangle your voice as a writer in that regard. And so I'm just pointing that out because it seems to sort of intersect with various different points we've made, but also like the platform that I created for myself with the podcast was all about liminality and being willing to leave structures behind and just enter into the unknown conceptually and intellectually and emotionally and psychologically and all the rest, and just use the tool that we or I have, which is speaking and writing in this context, to find my way through it, which is structure. I mean, you can't write or speak without relying on structure. But if you've come off the map conceptually and experientially, then it's all the other structures are pretty much gone. So it's like, for me, I really have to up my game. I guess that's why I've always tried to do that. Always tried to go into areas where I was uncertain and I didn't know really what I was doing, because then that would force me to really hone my ability to articulate just to make sense of what I was seeing. So I think that that would be the thing that would work for you. I feel very impetuous giving advice to an elder, but like, rather than just trying to rework writing and make it more authentic, it would be just stepping outside your zone of expertise and trying to write and communicate from there, because then you would probably find that your more structured approach, the academic approach, wouldn't work anyway. So that might allow just for a different voice to emerge naturally.
Well, I think that's good advice. I shall have to give that a try. But yeah, I think you're right in terms of reworking something that's there, or reworking on this thing that I've internalized as this mode of communicating is probably not going to be all that helpful. I need to get sort of like outside of the box a bit. And in one sense, I may have some advantage there in that I've never been a professional academic. I've just gone to academic conferences and published in academic journals and in academic book publishers. But I've never been a professional academic, so I have one foot in and sort of one foot out. And maybe that foot out that will help me to unextricate myself from or extricate myself from that influence. But
Unextricate yourself. That is an example of your structure collapsing for a second. Well, and it was just an email to me about Derrida, I presume. You just wrote it as an email, right? That has definitely been getting some good responses on Facebook, so I was trying to find you today so that I could you could see it and maybe join in. And it's not a big response because I don't have lots of friends.
You posted that on Facebook?
Well, I linked to my blog. I sent you the blog
Oh,
link, didn't I?
yeah, I saw it on your blog, but I didn't. I don't think we're friends. I'll have to respond to your friend request there and take a look. I'd certainly be happy to pitch into any comments or discussion that's going on.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because it's definitely a rich sort of vein there, because even without Jordan Peterson, there's a lot of hostility towards postmodernism. I don't know about a lot, but there's some, and I've definitely been sympathetic to it. And then there are others who are, quite in favor of postmodernism. So there's been some tension even in my small little Facebook circle, because I've been dissing postmodernism and people have been defending it, and actually I don't know half enough about it to really be dissing it. So it was good that we had that conversation, and then that you responded to Peterson's thing, and because he's certainly doing a good job of blackening its name.
Yeah, he's obviously no friend of people like Derrida, and I've seen that a lot though, and I just think Derrida has been so widely misunderstood in so many different ways by so many Americans, especially. And I know that that sounds a little what's the word? Arrogant to say something like that. I mean, like, who am I to say that I know what Derrida is saying? But I've looked at it long enough to be able to recognize some of the grosser misreadings and misconceptions that can be rather easily refuted by taking a look at his texts or pointing to certain passages in his texts where he just flat out refutes what people are accusing him of. Yeah, and I do get a little annoyed when I keep seeing that because, especially from academics who I don't think, from what I can tell, have really bothered to read his work very closely, if at all. They seem to be reading commentaries of people who have said very negative things about, and I keep saying Derrida because I don't have the same feeling toward a lot of the other postmodernists. I don't feel the same way about Foucault and although Deleuze is someone I like a little more than, but Derrida for me is the premier person, and he's the one who is the most precise and I think says the most interesting things. And so I attach to Derrida my whole notion of postmodernism, and yet Derrida himself would be saying, like, Greg, I don't want to be associated with the word postmodernism or any of the things that are often associated with it. And I can understand why Derrida felt that way, because so many of the other postmodern thinkers were not expressing things that he agreed with. And his philosophy in itself, I think, stands up much better to scrutiny. That's my take on postmodernism. I do understand why so many people don't like it. But I think it's a mistake to lump Derrida very quickly into that category. I think he deserves a much more much closer look, and that's where I don't. In many cases, I don't think he's gotten the closer look. People have just assumed, based on a few snippets that they've heard, that this is that Derrida belongs in the same bag.
Right.
I don't think he does.
So who coined the term postmodernism? Do you know?
Well, I think the person who made it a common household term was what's his name? The guy who wrote The Postmodern Condition. I want to say Lacan, but it wasn't Lacan. It was Lyotard. If I'm pronouncing it right, I'm terrible at pronouncing French.
What's his name?
Lyotard is Lyotard.
Not even heard of him.
The Postmodern Condition, where he describes what he feels are the elements of postmodernism, and I think he says some very interesting things, and I would agree with some of the ways in which he characterizes postmodernism. But I much prefer Derrida's philosophy, and if Derrida doesn't want to be called a postmodernist, I'm perfectly willing to go along with that. But I think Derrida should not be, held up to scorn in the same way that some of the other postmodernists are.
Well, because my very limited understanding of postmodernism, tracing it back to when I first kind of thought that I grasped it, I think I wrote about it briefly in my Natural Born Killers review, in Blood Poets. I'll have to go back and look, but was that it was more of a diagnosis than anything. I thought of postmodernism kind of as a diagnosing a condition, fragmentation and alienation and loss of meaning, and that all seems fine. But it seems that in our current day and age, it's become more of a solution or an ideology, and that doesn't seem good at all. Is there any validity in that view?
Well, I tend to lead. I mean, I think it's possible, as Lyotard does in his book, The Postmodern Condition, to view it as kind of a condition, as a place into which Western culture has evolved. But I also think of it as I like to use the word, although it's probably a mistake, I like to use the word metaphysics. I think postmodernism is as at least as Derrida works it out, is a metaphysical or a take on the metaphysical condition of the Western tradition. And specifically, to put it in a nutshell, I would say that it has everything to do with how we are viewing and understanding and structuring oppositional relations. When you think of what I call postmodern physics, like the physics of Einstein relativity and the physics of quantum theory and quantum mechanics, when you think of what has taken place there with respect to dichotomies, like the particle wave dichotomy, the dichotomy between absolute rest and motion. Absolute rest is no longer, and that's basically an Aristotelian concept, one that Newton continued to hang on to. But Newton's whole theory of motion initiated a break from this way of looking at dichotomies as, say, motion and at rest. You know, Newton realized that everything is at motion, and that therefore, consequently, everything has to be relative. And the kind of relativity that Einstein introduces is not a pernicious kind of anything goes relativity. And that's what a lot of people have attributed to postmodernists like Derrida, is that it's just a radical relativism, which is complete nonsense. It's much more analogous to actually Newtonian and Einsteinian relativities, in which everything is dependent on the, as we were talking about before, contextualization. You know, it's a form of contextualism, of understanding that everything has to be grounded in a context in order for you to be able to have any kind of measurement or assessment of it. And this has been, encountered over and over again in physics, quantum physics, and everything, the importance of context. And the same is true in looking at language and the whole process of meaning and interpretation and understanding texts. It's has to do with a very sophisticated understanding of context and the role of context and the unbounded nature of context. And when you begin to look at it that way, you can see a very a continuum from modernism to postmodernism that is very natural, just as you can get from Newton to Einstein very, very easily. And you won't find many scientists who will sit down with you and say that, Einstein is nuts. It's like, and in the same way, I don't think we should be saying Derrida is nuts. I mean, all he's doing is pointing out in a much stronger way the role of context and the way in which we ought to, all the different ways in which we ought to take that into consideration. So there's no real break between modernism and postmodernism as I see it. I see the one as flowing into the other. very naturally.
Do you know what Derrida's religious views were?
Well, he was Jewish. He was born in Algeria, and he's a Sephardic Jew, which means an African Jew. And he was not, however, an extremely devout or practicing Jew. He had enormous respect for Jewish tradition and whatnot. But to get a sense of that as to what Derrida's spirituality is, I would recommend reading something that I've written that I could, in fact, I could send you to it. It costs like $2.50 to buy it as a download on Amazon, but it's called Radical Atheism and New Spirituality.
Yeah, I'd like to read that.
And it's my extended take on where we're at as a culture right now with respect to spirituality, and I speak of the new atheists and what their views are and how those views might be critiqued. And I mentioned a guy by the name of Martin Haglund, which is Haglund, who is a philosophy professor at Yale, who, in my opinion, is currently the greatest philosopher in the world. I think he's incredible. But he's someone who has commented on and explained Derrida in a rather interesting way. And so the work that I'm talking about, Radical Atheism and New Spirituality, is it's available on Amazon, and it's a Kindle download. But it's I think you would enjoy reading it, especially parts of it. Give you a really good take on where Derrida sits with respect to spirituality and what his work means in that context.
Yeah, that would be good, because otherwise, if I start asking you about that, we'll be on another hour. And so do send that along, and if you don't mind, and I'll have a
Okay, yeah,
look
I'll
at it.
send you a link to that, or hell, if I can find my, I think I can find my, I might just send you the PDF file, the whole thing, and you wouldn't even have to download it.
Yeah, because I don't have a Kindle or anything like that.
Oh, you don't?
No,
Okay,
no.
yeah, I'll just locate it and send you the PDF of it, so you can read it at your leisure and see what you think of it.
Great. Well, it's also occurring to me that there's this chap, Charles Upton, who is on, he'll be on the podcast next week. So I'll send you the link when he's on, because he wrote a book called System of the Antichrist, New Age and Postmodernism or something. So he's another of the
Oh.
people out there who's got a very negative view of postmodernism. But he's a great writer and very, I would say, a very quite a wise spiritual person. And
Yeah,
so,
I'd be
but
very.
I don't think he knows much about Derrida, to be honest. So I was thinking, yeah, maybe I could get you two together and you could battle it out, and I could referee it or something. It'd be very interesting. 'Cause